It can get lonely climbing Mount McKinley, so to entertain myself, I go to ChumbaCasino.com. At Chumba Casino, I can play hundreds of online casino-style games for free, like online slots, bingo, slingo, and more. Plus, I get a daily login bonus. It's just too bad that up here, I don't have anyone to share my excitement with. Woohoo! Woo-hoo!
Live the Chumba life anytime, anywhere. Play for free now at ChumbaCasino.com. VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions 18 plus.
The following episode will contain references to stories and characters that may cause sudden and uncontrollable feelings of nostalgic joy and wonder. Listener discretion is advised.
You know who you are?
Steven is my name. Even Steven.
Will you say something, Steven?
Steven or Else Media.
A couple of regular fellas sit down and talk about Crisis on Infinite Earths. One of them knows a lot about DC, the other knows very little. That's today on Event or Else. Here it is, folks. Hit the road and lick the toad. It's time for Event or Else, the podcast where I go through most every major Marvel and DC event, one issue at a time, one episode at a time. And frankly, you need to stop giving me a hard time about it. I'm your host. My name is Steven, and we're going to do things a bit differently today. As you know, last week, we finished up our second big event, DC's Crisis on Infinite Earths from 1985. But rather than just jump right into our next event, which is going to be Secret Wars 2, I wanted to spend a little time reflecting on the crisis. And since I hate to reflect alone, I've invited a certain someone along for the ride. So, ladies and gentlemen, allow me to introduce our very first guest here on Event or Else. He's known up and down the internet superhighway as one of the OGs of comic book podcasting, and he's a founding member of Comic Geek Speak. He's the almighty podfather, folks, Peter Rios.
I sure hope I live up to that introduction.
Nobody ever does. How you doing?
I'm well. I'm doing very well. Happy to be part of Event or Else. You oftentimes mention that you do this because if you didn't, someone else would. I'm that someone else. Yeah. I'm that someone else that I've always wanted to do a huge deep dive on every single Marvel and DC event. And now I do it in my own head because you do it.
Yeah. Well, you know, I don't know if I ever told this story, but the reason I decided to do this ultimately was because I had started to read books digitally. I was getting a lot of Marvel books through Comixology Unlimited and through Hoopla. And I can't remember where I started. I remember reading, I think I started on Immortal Hulk. That's where it all started. I started reading Immortal Hulk, and it made reference to Hawkeye killing Bruce Banner with a gamma arrow. And I'm like, oh, when did that happen? And I looked, and it happened, I think, in, I don't remember what it happened in.
Civil War II, I think.
Civil War II, that's right. And so I started to read Civil War II, but then there was stuff referencing an earlier event. So I just kept going back and back and back. And finally, I was just like, you know what? I'm just going to start from Marvel Superhero Secret Wars. And then I thought, this would make a fun podcast. I'll just do both. And that's where we started. And I thought it would be fun to just read the events, not read any of the tie-ins. Of course, some of them, like when I get into Secret Wars 2, I read that as it was coming out. So I read most of the tie-ins back then. But when we get past, I think when I get really far in, I think Siege, I think I stopped reading comics in the middle of, no, when Fear Itself started at Marvel. That's when I kind of stopped reading comics. And so at some point, I'm going to be reading stuff from Marvel and DC and have no idea what's going on in either of those two universes. And I want to see if only reading the events, if that will give me all I need to know to understand, or if I'm just going to be totally confused. Either way, I think it'll be fun.
Yeah.
Podcast about stuff.
It's a great venture. It's a great idea. And I look forward to your journey.
Yeah. And now you read, because the whole reason I brought you on, you told me you were reading Crisis as it was coming out back in 85, right?
Absolutely. On the Crisis show that Adam and I occasionally do in the many, many years, I think we only got done with issue 6 so far. Yeah. And all the many, it's got to be over 10 years that we've been doing that podcast. One of our listeners coined the phrase Crisis Kid. Those of us who were there at the time reading this event as it was coming out, what that means, right? Like, what does that mean as a comic book reader? What does it mean as a DC fan? And ever since that, I think his name was AJ Campos. I use that term. I am a Crisis Kid.
Yeah. Yeah. See, I didn't read Crisis back in the day. I didn't get into DC until after Crisis. And it was only because my older brother was buying the books. I wasn't even buying comics at that point. He was going to the comic book store and he'd bring home his books, and he had a bedroom at the top of the stairs. And every night before bed, he would have books lay down on his stairs that I was allowed to read.
Oh, cool.
And so I jumped in with, I think DC was with Man of Steel, John Byrne's Man of Steel. That's kind of where I started.
Oh, see that? Yeah, that's not that far off.
It was pretty close after the Crisis. But it wasn't until maybe it was around 2005, 2006 that I actually sat down and read the Crisis for the first time. And then my son, who was a toddler at the time, he noticed the trade, and it just basically became his, because he just could not keep his eyes. There are so many characters in that book.
Yeah.
He just could not keep his eyes off that book. There was so much going on. He couldn't read at the time, but he just loved to pore over that book.
That's awesome.
And yeah, so when it comes to the big events, my first event was Secret Wars. That was my, and I read that at the time that it was coming out, again, because my older brother was buying the books.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. So let's just get some very general questions out of the way. What were some of your favorite moments from the Crisis?
I think for me, some of my favorite moments usually involved characters that I was reading at DC at the time showing up in the book, but then also being worried about what's going to happen with them, because this is all pre-internet and I wasn't really reading a lot of trade magazines or anything like that. I had no idea what was going to happen. There was only one moment that was quote unquote spoiled, a major moment, because of retail posters and whatever, but finding out what was going to happen to these characters. And it could be a little thing like just getting a new costume, certainly a bigger thing like, are they going to survive? But then also being introduced to all the new characters, who's who was running around the same time. So my sort of favorite general idea about Crisis is I was learning so much about the DC universe that I didn't know. I couldn't read Golden Age comics or Silver Age comics because trades weren't around, certainly not digital. And I had just gotten into DC in 1982, like hardcore reading superhero comics in 1982. So I had the perfect amount of knowledge to know who most of these characters or their relationships, to know how that all how all that was managed and how they related to each other. But I wasn't so beholden to these characters and concepts that I was against change. I was all for it. I was like, wow, this is blowing my mind. This is like, I knew probably more so than I knew reading Watchmen, I knew that Crisis was a major moment in comic.
Yeah. So that brings up a question then that I didn't actually write down. You said you were introduced to new characters in the Crisis. I know Dr. Light was a new character from Crisis. What other characters were new?
The entire Earth 4 group, Blue Beetle, Question.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Probably some, D, E, F level heroes and villains that if I didn't see them in Who's Who, I may have seen them for the first time in Crisis, because Perez was drawing everybody and now, wanted to draw everybody.
Did he? Because I wondered that as well as I was reading this. I felt like there were so many. I mean, I'm not familiar with a lot of them, but there were moments in the book like the World War One pilot that they would show every once in a while. Like, I can't, balloon guy.
Balloon
I can't remember.
Buster.
Balloon yeah, Balloon Buster. And I wondered, did he actually put every hero and villain in that series that was out at the time?
He certainly tried. And yeah. It wasn't scripted. You know, you can read many an article where he would say, Marv Wolfman would write, you know, give us 10 characters in this panel or on this page, and Perez would give you 100.
Yeah.
You know, because
that dude was crazy.
That's just the level of commitment, professionalism, creativity. He came to DC because he wanted to draw the Justice League and then gets a chance to draw the entire DC universe.
Yeah.
He was, as you call him on the episodes, the goat, the super goat. I mean, for yep. events, he basically invented the visual language for events for a long, long, long time.
Yeah. It's Secret Wars may be considered the first big event, but I think Crisis is the one that kind of defined what an event should be.
Absolutely.
Especially with, you know, there was some tie-in when it came to Secret Wars, mostly with how the heroes got onto the planet and then them coming out and, you know, wondering why did Spider-Man have this new costume, right? You know, that. But as far as tie-in books, good Lord, I haven't read any of the tie-in books, but I do have digitally, I haven't dug into them yet, the three volumes of the companion books that contain all the tie-ins, and the fact that it takes up three different volumes, that's a lot of books that tie yeah. in. That's kind of crazy.
Yeah.
Because
Crisis also has the same thing. They're not really tie-ins. They're more like lead-ups or prologues. There's the Monitor appearances throughout the DC yeah. universe before Crisis. There's the tie-ins during Crisis, the ones that have the banner. And in between that, which probably most of these issues aren't in those compendiums, you have the books that aren't bannered, but they clearly have Red Skies, Bad Weather, you yeah. know, things like that. And then there are a few epilogue tie-ins as well that sometimes they get included and sometimes they
don't. Yeah. Yeah, I don't know when I'll dig into those, but they're there waiting for me.
Yeah.
All right. So stretch your mind back to you're reading the Crisis for the first time. Who were the heroes that really stuck out to you? Who were the ones that were your favorites as you were reading the Crisis?
Well, the ones who stuck out are the new ones, the ones that were created specifically for the series and who really become, as you mentioned about Pariah, the point people in the series. I wanted to know about Pariah. I wanted to know about Lady Quark, Dr. Light, the new Monitor, the Anti-Monitor, Harbinger, Alexander Luthor. They were the ones I really followed. And beyond that, if I had to pick like a secondary tier, Flash, Barry Allen Flash was obviously another point person because yeah. he gets involved in the main story quite often. That was, I think as I originally read it, but mostly as I read it in the many years after, for me, the larger narrative sometimes is stronger. And those characters, those freshly made characters for the Crisis are the ones I always follow. Because everybody else is along for the ride. The Justice League, along for the ride. The JSA, along for the ride. Now, you could say Superman of Earth 2 has a very strong journey throughout mm-hmm. issue 1 through 12, obviously, because he's quote unquote the first.
Yeah.
So he definitely has an arc, which once you read, especially as I read it as a kid, once you get to those last final chapters, you're like, man, that, wow, just what happens.
Yeah.
Just amazing. So,
yeah, he was one of those guys that, you know, when it gets to those last, especially the last issue, when he's just like, you know what, the Anti-Monitor just keeps getting up and I'm putting him down. He was pretty awesome.
Right.
In that last issue.
And I don't think you could give, I don't think Superman of Earth 1 could have done that.
Yeah.
I think they purposely gave it to Superman of Earth 2 because one of the episodes you mentioned that he punches a saber tooth. Superman of Earth 1 wouldn't have punched the saber tooth. You know, the Superman of Earth 2 was a little rougher because if he's based on those Golden Age stories, he did rough people up.
And
So for him to be the one to stop the big bad and do it in the manner that he did, it totally makes sense.
That's what was kind of fun for me. This is probably the third time I've read The Crisis, but it's the first time I've read it since I've started reading all the Golden Age Superman stories with Ed for the Superman Super Show. Now we're not that far into it. I think the next book we're going to read, I believe it's Action Comics 24. That's as far as we are at this point into Golden Age Superman, but I see a lot of that in this Superman of Earth 2, and it's kind of fun and it's neat seeing that. So what was the question I was going to ask? Oh, now you haven't heard the episodes for 10, 11, and 12 yet, because as the time we're recording this, those haven't been released. But one of the things I talk about in episode 12 is the Superman of Earth 2, his power level compared to the Superman of Earth 1, because there's that moment there at the near the end when Superman of Earth 1, he's ready to take it to the Anti-Monitor, and Lady Quark says, "I got your back," basically. And Superman of Earth 2 just one punch knocks them both unconscious. And that blew me away. Was he a more powerful character?
I don't know if it's so much that he's a powerful character, but if you remember in issue 7, once you travel to the antimatter universe, all of the supers could be hurt because moment, I think, with Superman of Earth 2 where he gets punched and touches his nose and says, "Oh my God, I'm bleeding."
Yeah.
So if you factor that in, if you factor that they're fighting the anti-monitor, they're getting bombarded. And then if you just factor in the notion of Superman of Earth 2 at that moment has nothing to live for, but he has everything to die for. So he could absolutely do, channel all of that power and rage and emotion, you know. And maybe it's a moment, an element of surprise thing or whatever. They get knocked out hard enough. They get basically carried out. And then he's the one that's left behind. So I think there's a lot of those factors in it.
Okay. So there were a number of deaths in the crisis. Of course, the big ones were Barry Allen, Flash, and Supergirl. But a couple of them I had some questions about, because you had they make a specific point of showing you in the final issue that Robin and Huntress of Earth 2 and Cole of the Teen Titans, their bodies were never found.
Yeah.
And I wondered, does that mean were they ever brought back in any kind of storyline before the multiverse came back?
No, I think Cole showed up. Years later, like during the Geoff Johns run, I want to say, or maybe a little bit earlier than that. But as far as Huntress and Earth 2 Dick Grayson, they're gone. I mean, they're showing up now, and they have showed up here and there. Paul Levitz, I think, brought back Helena Wayne in like sometime after the New 52. There was some mystery of who this new Huntress was, and it was a Helena, but these specific characters, they were fated to die because they were duplicates. And that's of all the deaths, that was one of those are one of the sadder ones, because they were disintegrated. I mean, it wasn't even the antimatter wall. It was I think it was the shadow demons just overwhelmed them, if I remember correctly.
Yeah. So do you think specifically saying in the issue that their bodies were never found, do you think that was kind of their way to say, look, these folks are never coming back, so just forget them, because we're not even going to show you bodies. That's how dead they are. That's how wiped from existence they are.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the beauty of the antimatter wall too. As you mentioned way back in the first episode, it literally is erasing people. And we always talk about that on the Crisis tapes of, it's such a metatextual thing. You know, you can make it a scientific thing, matter versus antimatter, but it's literally a comic book thing. Someone is erasing these people from the very fabric of the DC universe. And as far as a Robin and Huntress of Earth 2, yeah, that's what you got to do. You got to. That's why Green Arrow, the Earth 2 Green Arrow, died in issue 12.
Yeah.
Because they just could not allow any more. They did not want to allow any more duplicates. So of all of the deaths, you could kind of make the argument, and certainly some writers did this, that someone like Supergirl, someone like Barry Allen Flash, there are ways to bring them back. And there are enough fans that if they brought them back, they would be okay with it. But then there's a whole bunch of other heroes and villains that once they were dead, DC kind of just was like, eh, we don't really need them. You know, do we really need Cole anymore? Wolfman created her for New Teen Titans specifically for her to die.
That's what I was going to ask you about. Yeah. I heard a podcast a couple of weeks back say that as a theory, that he knew he was going to have to kill off somebody from the Titans. And rather than kill off an existing character, he just created one to be killed off later. Okay.
Right. Yeah. I mean, he did kill Dove, who was they were their own heroes, but then they did join Titans West. So he did kill, that was another Titan that died. But the ones that he had his hand in, right. Yeah. He said, if I have to ask all of these other editors to give me victims, quote unquote, for my death list, then I better make sure I have one as well.
Yeah. So speaking of Hawk and Dove,
I'm sorry. I also forgot Aqua Girl. She was also.
Yeah. 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 It's a pretty big list. It's pretty crazy. And a lot of them stayed. I mean, good Lord, how long did Barry Allen stay dead before they brought him back? 30 years, something like that. Yeah.
Event or Else will return after these messages.
How to have fun anytime, anywhere. Step one, go to ChumbaCasino.com.
ChumbaCasino.com. Got it.
Step two, collect your welcome bonus.
Come to Papa, welcome bonus.
Step three, play hundreds of casino-style games for free.
That's a lot of games, all for free.
Step four, unleash your excitement.
Woo-hoo! Chumba Casino has been delivering thrills for over a decade. So claim your free welcome bonus now and live the Chumba life. Visit ChumbaCasino.com.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions, 18 plus.
And now, back to Event or Else.
So with Hawk and Dove, that's something I was also curious about. They killed off Dove, but we had a Hawk and Dove post-crisis, right? Am I remembering correctly that Dove was a woman post-crisis?
Yep. Okay. Yes. Yeah. It was a new character.
I don't know that I've ever read any Hawk and Dove. I don't have a lot of history with those characters.
It was an okay series.
That's where Rob Liefeld cut his teeth, right?
Yeah, he did. It was an okay series. It's an okay concept. They managed to mine Hawk and Dove for quite a while. And then I think we saw Dove again during Blackest Night.
Yeah.
He does make an appearance back again, but he was one of those that has stayed dead for a long time.
All right. Okay. So in issue 12, a lot of my questions seem to come from the issue 12, the way it was wrapped up. They kind of make a point to show us in the final arc, almost the epilogue kind of the issue, to show us what the status quo of the new DC is moving forward. And they show us a couple of quick things. For example, they show us that Jonah Hex has now been placed in the future. And I know that they had a book with that concept. So I felt like that moment was their kind of spinoff. It's like, here's something to look forward to. Here's Jonah Hex in the future. But they mentioned another character that I don't have any history about, and that's Commandy. Mm-hmm. And coming out of Crisis, the great disaster never happened, but this boy, something having to do with Command D. What's that all about? Was that its own book? Did that storyline show up somewhere? Tell me about that.
So Command D is a Jack Kirby creation and was created during the 70s, shortly after all of his New Gods stuff. And it was the one title, I want to say it's the one title when Kirby came over to DC that number one lasted the longest. And I think he lasted the longest on that title as opposed to the other titles. He didn't do the entire run, but I if I'm remembering right, he did a big amount of those comics. It was all based on sort of like a restructured idea that he had for Planet of the Apes. And Commandy is just a human boy during the what's called the Great Disaster, which at the time probably, I don't know, I haven't read all the issues and my memory is not super perfect on this, but you get the idea that it happened after a war, probably World War III at the time.
Yeah.
Because, you know, in the Great Disaster, someone had found Superman's costume and his cape, you know, so there was an idea that the Age of Heroes had existed. So as a young boy, he was found in a bunker called Command D, and that's why he's named Command.
Oh, okay.
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 But what's happening here is that whoever initially found him, which I can't remember, because he's also tied into OMAC, One Man Army Corps.
Okay.
The guy who is OMAC is Commandy's grandfather, and I can't remember if he's the one who found him or not. That I don't remember. So what the Crisis decides to do, and what this sequence is really trying to do, it's trying to lay out an established future for the DC Universe. They were no longer going to have the Great Disaster. Jonah Hex was the Hex title, the one that takes place in the future, was already a couple issues in by the time Crisis ended. So they wanted to say, this is the new future going forward, not the Great Disaster, but Hex's future, and then eventually down the road, Legion of Superheroes. So what they did was, since they couldn't have a Great Disaster, the boy who used to be Commandy, he is found by this General Horatio Tomorrow. He's given a new name, Thomas, and now he becomes an already established DC sci-fi character named Tommy Tomorrow.
Okay.
So they managed, and Tommy Tomorrow was part of the Planeteers during DC's sci-fi era. You know, Adam Strange, Captain Comet, Tommy Tomorrow, the Star Rovers, et cetera, et cetera. So they basically just took two DC concepts, peanut butter and you know, chocolate, and put it together. If we can't have Commandy, we still want maybe those stories, or we want to know that that character could have been around. We're just going to make him a new character. Okay. That concept, though, I don't think sticks for long.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, is it your recollection that a lot of what they did, because the whole point of the Crisis, of course, was Marv Wolfman felt that readers were confused by the multiverse. He was getting letters from kids that didn't quite understand why there were two Supermen and didn't make a lot of sense. So they came up with the Crisis to eliminate the multiverse, make the one universe. Do you remember at the time, was there a lot of grumbling about that? Did you talk to readers back then that were upset that they were getting rid of the multiverse?
I'm sure that there were more established comic book readers that had been around, you know, maybe since the 60s and 70s that were like, okay, what is going on? Why? All you have to do is read some of the letter columns in Crisis, and you would probably hear some gripes, you know, here and there. And there were definitely creators, certain editors who didn't want to play along with the Crisis. If you ever get the Absolute Crisis, you read some of those backstories, that's where you get like a lot of backstories of Wolfman saying there were some editors that just sat there at meetings and just pouted because they were like, how dare you interrupt what I want to do, blah, 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 blah. Roy Thomas wasn't particularly fond because he, as he puts it, he was promised some things about the Crisis that didn't necessarily pan out, you know, because they were doing away with all of his concepts, basically.
Yeah.
And then he had to work around all of that. In terms of fans, readers, I don't necessarily remember anybody in my own circle because we were, like I said, we were still young. Let's see, 1985. So the first issue came out in January of 1985, which means I was 12. Okay. So that is the perfect age for, you know, to blow a young comic book reader's mind.
Oh, yeah.
With this kind of thing. So me and my friends, those of us who were reading DC Comics, I don't know if we knew anybody who was really hardcore against it. Certainly, in hindsight, there are people who I might have read in letter columns shortly after it, you know, where they say things like, ugh, you know, there goes all my favorite characters, my favorite concepts. I wasn't confused. So why is DC doing this? You know, which are all valid points, I guess. But no, I don't remember as you said, it was the benchmark of events. It is the benchmark of events. And it was so different from Secret Wars that it was reading Revelations for a publishing line. And who did that? Nobody did that at the time.
Yeah.
So even for those people who said they probably didn't like it, I bet you they were reading it.
Oh, yeah. That's how it is with comic book readers, right? The only way they know to complain is if they're reading it. So, but imagine then if the internet was a thing back then, if social media the way it is now was a thing back then, I have to assume that it would be blasted. People would be complaining all over the place about this. Cause I feel like Infinite Crisis, that was probably one of the first real kind of big events that I felt like I was coming into brand new.
Right.
Though I'd been reading some DC previously, because I read Millennium and Legends. But I feel my memory of the time was that on the internet, people just did not. They were very upset with Infinite Crisis and a lot of complaining. And yet, when I hear people talk about it nowadays, I hear it just praised and talked about how great it was. And I enjoyed it. I remember really liking it.
I think it's because, you know, Infinite Crisis and Civil War were the two first events that the internet could really participate in. I know that's going to sound weird because it was in the middle 2000s, but it was because certainly podcasting was was a big factor, so that you could hear people talk about these events. And also message boards really blew up. Blogging really blew up in the 2000s. Yep. It wasn't just news groups. It wasn't just chat rooms. It was hardcore. You know, the comic book blogging sphere of the early 2000s. And I do absolutely think that podcasting really helped to reignite fandom in many ways.
Yep.
DC was having a huge amount of a success at the time, creatively and monetarily and idea-wise. And yeah, I think you're right. While there were extreme reactions to Infinite Crisis and Civil War, the discussion, I can remember those two events having so much discussion. So I think, you're right. In hindsight, those two events will always have a place in people's minds, because maybe they were the first event for a whole new generation of readers.
Yep.
Certainly an event that everybody could share in the moment. You could go back and listen to podcasts about them, like a time capsule. So I think you're spot on about that.
Okay. So do you think DC accomplished their mission at the time to make the DC universe more reader friendly following the crisis?
I think you answer it both ways. Yes, because I was already a DC fan, but I became more of a DC fan.
Yeah.
I think yes, because a lot of people came over to DC at that time, mostly probably because of John Byrne doing Superman.
Yep.
Everybody was excited about Perez and company on Wonder Woman.
Yeah.
Suddenly Batman was getting revolutionized, and it seemed to keep happening across the board that instead of starting new number one issues across the board, when they did start, like Wally West's Flash, Suicide Squad, which I guess more came out of Legends, but it gave an opportunity, Blue Beetle, Booster Gold, Captain Atom, the opportunity was there to get in on the ground floor. So for clarity's sake, that's amazing. That's great, because you can, you know, the trick of it is And this is what long-time readers probably experienced. The question was, okay, well then now what is still in continuity?
Right.
And what isn't? That's really the confusion. And that's why not starting everything over at one again, or not doing a new 52 format in 1986 probably hurt them. Plus you had those grumpy editors and creators who were like, I don't care. I'm going to do it my way anyway. You know, I'm going to bring this character back, or I'm going to ignore the crisis happened. And Wolfman couldn't, he's not in charge of that, you know?
Right. Yeah. And you know, it's one of the challenging things that I came across a couple of years back when I kind of decided, you know what, I want to start reading DC Comics post-crisis. Where do I start? And there's not really, one would think, all right, well, the month after issue 12 hit, that's when the post-crisis DC universe starts. But that's not true. There's not really a one point in time, one month, one week that you can go to and go, all right, start reading comics here. It's all post-crisis. Because there were still some, it's a very muddy period when it comes to continuity, I feel. But I think in general, I think it was a better place for new readers, especially new readers coming in. I know that, again, that's the whole reason I got into the DC is because my brother started buying them. And I feel like he started buying them primarily for John Byrne because he had been reading the Fantastic Four and the X-Men and Alpha Flight and all that junk. And so he wanted to get that. But then I look at the DC comics of today, and it's funny because when it comes to reading new books from the big two, I've always been a Marvel zombie. But when I look at new books from DC and I look at new books from Marvel, I'm way more into the DC books. The Marvel books, for some reason, they just confuse me. I don't know. It doesn't feel like Marvel comics anymore. DC still feels like DC. I don't know how to explain it. I feel like the Marvel Cinematic Universe did something to the comic book universe that makes it a little different. And it's kind of hard for me to get back into. Whereas DC, I just seem to be able to just jump back in. However, having said that, not only is the multiverse back, now we have a multiverses. And I think the DC Comics continuity today is way more confusing than it was before the crisis even started.
Right.
And I find that kind of funny. How long do you think it was? I think of characters like Hawkman, for example. How long do you think it was after crisis ended before it started to get confusing again?
Yeah. You had several properties that will forever be victims of crisis. Hawkman is one. Donna Troy is another. Legion of Superheroes is another. Anybody that was affected by a lot of those continuity changes, and it didn't take long because to focus on Hawkman, Tim Truman does that amazing 3-issue Hulk World series that reignites Hawkman's origin. It's called Hulk World. It gives new backstory. It plays within existing stories. It just expands upon the origin. It is beautiful. It's sad. It's just really great. It's a great 3-issue series if you've never read it. The problem is, because it was so popular and because they found a way to, you know, this is post Dark Knight, where if you were put in a prestige format book, Green Arrow, The Longbow Hunters, Black Hawk, Blood and Iron, Hawk World, even Adam Strange, The Fall of Adam Strange had a miniseries as well that was in prestige format. That kind of, they used it as opportunities to really dig in deep. It was kind of like the Black Label line before Black Label even existed.
Yeah.
So they took the success of Hawk World and said, all right, we're going to make a Hawk World series. The problem is they made it that both Hawkman and Hawk Girl or Hawk Woman were arriving on Earth for the first time.
Yeah.
What the heck happens to all the Hawk people that were in the Justice Society and the JLA that just had a series during the crisis? So a simple fix would have been if they just would have said on on issue one, after the three-issue Hawkworld series, you open up that first new series and they would have just said 10 years later and it was here present time, you know? Yeah. Because then you can just say, oh, all that happened within the 10 years. We're just starting from a quote-unquote new place in their life post-crisis. So some of it was because they wanted to distance themselves from pre-crisis trappings, but then they wound up in a whole other trap. So it didn't take long to confuse. Now, we didn't get back a multiverse. It wasn't like we got back multiverses or anything like that.
Right.
But, you know, John Byrne brings back Supergirl, but she's not really Supergirl. She's this protoplasmic being, you know?
Yeah.
Wolfman and Perez have to figure out what to do with Donna Troy. Paul Levitz and Greg LaRocque have to figure out what to do with the inspiration for Legion of Superheroes because Superboy never existed, you know?
Yeah.
It wasn't so much that, I don't know if it was necessarily confusion. It was more, again, what matters and what doesn't matter, what counts and what doesn't count. And some new properties could roll on and it didn't matter. And other new things, there were some questions that were popping up. I don't quite remember. It's been a while since I dug deep into the reasons why they wanted to do Zero Hour, which was technically like the next continuity fix. But I have to imagine that some trade has an introduction as to why that, you know, or back issue, you know, like I said, it's been a while since I've read that. That would probably give you a really good answer as to the years between Crisis and Zero Hour, what was going on. Part of it was Hawkman, like I said. Part of it was also aging, like Green Lantern was suddenly older. Green Arrow was certainly older, but other how do you fit all these, you know, characters within the timeline? How do you all make sense? How does it all make sense? It brought back the Justice Society of America because they were off the plate. DC was like, nope, can't do anything with them. But you sort of question, well, why not? They just take place in World War II now. It doesn't matter if it's Earth 1 or Earth 2. They are a World War II concept. So why are you, the only reason they really wanted to get rid of them is they just kind of wanted to shelve them a bit because they are the past.
Yeah.
So plus I think the other factor is a lot of readers were finally saying, okay, it's been enough time. We need some of these concepts back again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. It's funny. I was, I've been trying to, prepare for, I'm thinking about launching another podcast for some reason. having to do with post-crisis Superman, basically. And, I don't know if you've ever gone over to the Byrne Robotics site and read through his FAQ, but he does talk about starting, you know, the Man of Steel and, eliminating Superboy and what that meant for the Legion. And according to him, his side of the story is that he asked them at one point, so what are we going to do about the Legion? Because if we're not going to have Superboy, then you can't have a Legion of superheroes. And he claims the editors basically were like, we don't have to worry about that. And then
right,
not long before issue one of Man of Steel launched, one of these editors called him up and said, oh my God, what are we going to do about the Legion? And he said, well, I thought we talked about that. I told you guys about that. So they had to come up with some way to figure out, you know, why did the, you know, what was it that they were just inspired by Superman, hearing Superman stories from the past, or?
They were initially inspired by Superboy pre-crisis, and then post-crisis, it's, you know, it becomes a whole thing. Yeah. I mean, I think the simple fix would have just been, at the time, you just get inspired by Superman, you know?
Yeah.
But, you know, it became this whole other thing. It's I always tend to take Byrne's words lightly because you know, he's a great fabricator or he's a great fable maker, and he loves to tell fables, and sometimes you're like, is this real, is this right? You know, there's a lot of other things that sort of contradict whatever, so but whatever, it is what it is. So that'll be a fun journey for you.
Did you guys have John Byrne on Comic Geek Speak at one point?
No.
No. Have you ever met him?
No, but I've heard him talk a lot.
Yeah, I met him once. He was back in the 90s, I think it was not long after Namor came out, I was working at a comic book store, and we were going to have a table at, I guess, what became Planet Comic Con in Kansas City. That they weren't calling it that at the time, but John Byrne was going to be there. So I filled up a short box of John Byrne comics, and I remember getting in line when I had my first break, and I think there was a sign up that said that you could only have 25 books signed at one time, which is pretty amazing, you know, 25 books. And so I went up there with 25 books, and I said, can you, you know, make them out to me? And I gave him my name, and he was very friendly. And then an hour later, when I came back, I got so many books signed by him, and he was very polite and fun, and every, you know, after I think the third time I got up to his table, he remembered me, but then yet I hear stories about him at conventions that he's just so rude to people. And so he just must be one of those guys that if you catch him in the right mood, you know, he's either going to be just a wonderful man or just a hateful, spiteful jerk, you know?
Yeah, there's a ton of Byrne stories out there.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Event or Else will return after these messages. And now, back to Event or Else.
All right. Let me ask this real quick. I have really kind of two big questions left.
Okay.
There were some moments near the end of Crisis that I'm wondering if I read these tie-in issues, if I'm going to get more of the story. So, for example, I know that I think it's issue 9 where Nightwing and Starfire and Jericho get on that spaceship, and then they leave the Crisis. And we got a little editor's note that says, go to Teen Titans. So I know I can find out what happened with them. And I know that, you know, there was an editor's note when Guy Gardner showed up, and then he goes off to do what he's going to do and read Green Lantern to find out what's going on with him. But there were a couple moments, like in issue 11, there was a detectives convention that had like Harvey Bullock and just all kinds, every DC detective. And they stumble across the murder of a character named Angleman, who I had literally only heard just weeks before I read this, if even that, because there's an issue of that World's Finest that Mark Waid's doing where somebody has the Angleman's triangle or whatever it is. And then I'm reading Crisis, and here it is in Crisis. And so that goes nowhere. I'm assuming it picks up somewhere else. And then there's the moment, I think it's also in issue 11 with Amethyst, where all these villagers attack her and she goes blind. Who is it? The demon and Phantom Stranger come to her rescue. And
Dr. Fate.
Okay. Yeah. Are these storylines that I'm going to be able to pick up on somewhere else in DC?
Yes. They, you know, at some point in the Crisis, they start to do that whole thing about, here are tie-ins, or basically they're promoting their line. Some people seem to think that was something that was going on since issue 1 of Crisis, and it actually is not.
I don't feel like I saw any of that until the last quarter of the series.
Because the first issue came out in January 1985. It ran from the entire year of 1985. But the story itself takes place in July of 1985, like as it says in the first issue.
Yeah.
And that was because they wanted to set it a few months later than where the actual publishing line was, to give them time to, you know, catch up and say, okay, you have 4 or 5 months until you have to start reflecting in your books. So that was smart. So then that meant it probably took another 2-3 months before they can work backwards and go, okay, what are you doing in your book? Here's what we can do. We can throw a nod into Crisis. That was something that when I talked about editors, Wolfman was like, hey, we're doing this thing. Let me know what you think you could do with your characters, and we'll put them in the book, and then you can spin off into whatever story you wanted to tell. He was writing Titans at the time. It's a no-brainer. He can do whatever he wants.
Yeah.
that particular story has nothing to do with the crisis once they leave. The Amethyst thing does have to do with the crisis, but it more has to do with how do we bring this sword and sorcery character who was already established within the DC universe, how do we make her more part of the DC universe? So that spins off into her Bannered issues at the end of her second series. And then what was the middle one you said?
The Detectives Convention.
That was completely just for the series. That doesn't spin off anywhere. What I love about it is in the earlier issues of Crisis, as you mentioned, you have all the war heroes that get to have a scene together. Yep. But that wasn't unheard of, right? You could go back and read war comics and, you know, those characters sometimes crossed over. But then you had a part of Crisis around issue 3 where all the Western characters meet up together.
Yep.
Come on, that's awesome, right? Like you get to see all their West. They probably didn't actually exist all in the same years, but it doesn't matter. Yeah. That's what the crisis is, right? So I think that's another nod to the detective thing. Here's Harvey Bullock. Here's Joni Thunder. Was Roy Raymond part of it? And I forget, maybe Christopher Chance. I forget who all was in it. The mystery, we think, if I'm remembering it right, the person who was the killer for Angleman, you could say that it's really a nod to the Shadow Demons, because that particular scene takes place after all the Earths merge into one.
Yep.
So in everybody's mindset, the Anti-Monitor, we don't know where he is, and we don't know what happened to the Shadow Demons. So I think that was meant to show that they're still around. Some people also say that it has something to do with like the big villain war. I'd have to look that up. I don't know. I forget the particulars of it, but my gut feeling was that, you know, people were still dying because the Shadow Demons were still around. So, or some people also said, and this one I actually like, is that his angler device, he could go to different dimensions, but technically there aren't other dimensions. So he probably tried it and was like, there was a feedback and he blew up. So that could be another explanation.
Yeah. Yeah, I felt it was odd, first of all, that I'd never heard of this character of Angleman, and he pops up in a brand new issue of World's Finest, and then I happen to read him mentioned in this in Crisis. I thought that was kind of fun.
Yeah.
But it was kind of a weird scene. The scene with all the war heroes and the scene with all the Western heroes, that all made sense because it had to do with the towers and, you know, that all made sense. But this one just felt like it came out of left field. Kind of, there's also another one. I don't know if it's in the same issue or not, but we get a few panels in Gorilla City.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if Detective Chimp is normally somebody who hangs out at Gorilla City, or if they just thought, all right, let's get some, because there was also a guy there called Sam Simeon.
Mm-hmm.
And I mentioned it in the episode when we get to that, when that episode comes up. But part of me felt like, I don't know if characters like Detective Chimp or Sam Simeon just hang out in Gorilla City, or did they just put them there because they're apes, you know?
Right.
So exactly. Those are both kind of weird. But even that one still made a little bit more sense. It didn't feel like it came out of left field, because you get an update on King Solivar, who was injured like way back in issue 2 or 3 or something.
Right.
So, yeah, but I think the most fun I had with this series, there was a few moments where just coming across characters I'd never heard of or seen before. And, well, we'll use the character of Mento, for example, because I asked you who he was.
Yeah.
And, you know, like I said, I've read this 3 times and I don't remember seeing the guy the first 2 times. And I've just within the last couple of days, I realized why he stood out to me. And that's, I don't know if you've ever heard of the Aquabats.
Yeah.
They were they're a band from California who dresses up in costume, and they, you know, like they're a kid's show. And they had their own show on TV called the Aquabat Super Show, which you can find on YouTube. They're wonderful. I love them. But like their first episode features a villain named Man Ant, who is a man-sized half-man, half-ant guy. And his minions wear like black and purple costume type things, and they wear motorcycle helmets with antenna on them. And that's what Mento looks like. He's wearing a motorcycle helmet with antenna. And I was really kind of disappointed when I went out to try to find where can I read more about this guy. And everything I found, he was in a completely different costume. I don't know do you have any idea how long he was in that costume?
Not long. I think it might have been was it his first costume? I don't remember now. And he's drawn in that costume occasionally. Once he gets into New Teen Titans with Wolfman and Perez, they sort of redesign his costume, I believe. It's not long.
I just found his look to be wonderfully ridiculous.
Yeah.
It looked really homemade. You know, I could totally see that character showing up on like one of these shows nowadays, like Peacemaker or something, with just a spandex suit with some shorts and a motorcycle helmet that he's glued antenna on.
Right.
I just found him very fun. But the one character really stood out to me, and I think it was issue number 12. I think he's in one panel and then he dies. The Bug-Eyed Bandit.
Bug-Eyed.
Does he ever come back?
Oh, I don't know. I'm not sure if he does. I mean, Perez was definitely one of the motivators behind killing off what he considered to be silly characters.
Yeah.
You know, and there's another character named the Ten-Eyed Man who he was like, come on, we need to kill. In fact, I think he's in the same sequence where Robin and Huntress die. And he's like, I'm going to kill him off. So apparently the Bug-Eyed Bandit, there was a son of the Bug-Eyed Bandit that showed up in Adventures of Superman 608 from 2002.
Oh.
So, and then there was a Bug-Eyed Bandit, maybe the same one, within Villains United during Infinite Crisis. So he has made a secondary appearance.
when I ran across him, you know, because I read that issue and then I go to make a list of everybody that died in that issue because I wanted to talk about it on that episode. And I see this character, you know, this, I find a list and I see this character named the Bug-Eyed Bandit. And I just shook, what is that? And I go back and I look at the issue and it's literally one panel, him and I think it's Clayface die in the same panel. And it's the only real mention in that entire issue that you understand that it's not just the heroes that are fighting these shadow demons, that some villains are fighting back against them as well.
Right.
But I had to look him up and, you know, found out that he was a foe of the Atom, which made a lot of sense to me because he controlled little robot bugs and stuff. And I find characters like that really interesting, and it makes me wonder when they're going to show up on, you know, some of these. I haven't really watched much of Doom Patrol, but I figure if a character like that is going to show up on one of these DC shows, it's either going to be Peacemaker or the Doom Patrol.
Yeah. So a version of the character shows up on the Brave and the Bold cartoon. And in the Arrowverse, there's a female version named Bree Larvan instead of Bertram Larvan. So she has, that character has also shown up in the Arrowverse, not with the costume, of course, but
I always, and I love the names. I love when they give these heroes and villains their real name, their real identity, their name matches their hero or villain identity. Johnny Storm and stuff like that. That just Johnny Blaze, you know, that's funny. Jack Russell. That's like a dad joke to me. Jack Russell calling a werewolf character Jack Russell just makes me laugh. The last character I wanted to talk about, because I gave this guy a lot of crap throughout the issue. Any issue that he showed up in, I gave him some crap because
can I guess?
I think
who it is?
He's go ahead.
Is it Simon?
Yes. He is the dumbest looking character I've ever seen, but he's treated almost with some reverence. Like he was a feared, powerful character that if he showed up in a book, you were like, oh no, it's going down now. who was what books did he show up in? Who was his hero or heroes that he'd go up against?
I think it'll all make sense once you find out. He was created for the new Teen Titans.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah, that makes sense why he shows up a lot in the series then.
Exactly.
He just looks so ridiculous.
He's a Wolfman Perez creation. He was part of a team that Dr. Light, the original Dr. Light, created to fight, to be crime people. But then they went up against New Teen Titans. And then eventually he took over the team of the Fatal Five. They were called the Fatal Five. Or is it the Fearsome Five? Wait a minute. It's a Fearsome Five. I always get my fives confused. Yeah. The Fearsome Five. And he was created. I mean, he eventually took over leadership and he has mind powers. Yeah. The Fearsome Five were also, they went up against the new Teen Titans when they crossed over with Batman and the Outsiders, which was a really cool two-issue crossover. And they were also used much later, including Simon, when Judd Winnick was writing the Outsider series in the early 2000s.
Yeah.
They've been around for a long time, and he is fearsome, even though he is so ridiculous looking. But as you said, you know, he's a Wolfman Perez creation, so of course he's in the crisis.
Well, and the thing is, I think I could take him just a little bit more seriously if it were not for the ponytail. I mean, if you're going to have the top of your head removed and replaced with a glass dome so people can see your brain, just shave all your hair off. Don't you're like one of these guys that is bald on top but leaves the ring of hair at the bottom. You know, what are you clinging to there? Just shave it off.
Right.
Because
right.
It looks ridiculous. No offense to anybody who looks that way. I call that the Lou Grant hairstyle. But whenever he'd show up and he'd be like, I'm a villain and I'm going to take you down. I just couldn't take him seriously. But he did come across as a very powerful guy.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, you give him the name Simon, just ooh. It's like a dad joke. It's those ridiculously awful, wonderful things at the same time.
Yeah. I mean, New Teen Titans was such a popular series, but you got to remember it spawned out. It first hit stands in 1980. So it is both a 80s book, but still has echoes of 70s Bronze Age ridiculousness, you know, and that's why you get characters like Simon, which I think his real name is Simon, and that's why he's named it. Yeah, Simon Says. So
I wonder if he likes to do drawings. that's a callback for folks our age, you know, because I was also 12 in January, and I would have turned 13 during the crisis. So
right.
Now I threw out a theory at one point in one of the episodes. And I know you've had a thing or two to say about the Anti-Monitor when his look changes partway through the series and he puts on this new armor. And my theory is that the reason, because they don't really give you a reason that he changed his armor or his look. But my theory is that George Perez got tired of, you know, he was already drawing so much and he... You know, you got the Anti-Monitor. He's got all kinds of stuff on his costume, little lines and pipes and things hanging off him. And he's like, I got to streamline his look to make it easier for future issues. So he just gives him that slick armor. That was my theory.
I don't know what it is. Adam and I, we call it his whale look. I don't like the second costume. I don't know. You know, you could have changed the costume and come up with something a little better. Maybe it is meant to have all that tubing because Supergirl did really almost destroy his body and he has to have some kind of containment. But he looks partly like a Michelin Man and partly like a whale. And it's like kind of like, it doesn't look as intimidating as his first look. And maybe Perez wanted to just get away from, as you mentioned, looking too much like the Monitor.
Yeah. You know, and there's, for me, there's appealing things about both of his looks and there are unappealing things about both of his looks. It almost feels like the first version of the Anti-Monitor is like 70s Anti-Monitor, and then the new, you know, the new armor is 80s Anti-Monitor. That's kind of the way I look at it.
Yeah. New Coke Anti-Monitor.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Kind of like when they in Secret Wars, when Dr. Doom updates his armor.
Yeah.
But that was primarily because that was an edict from the toy company,
sure,
which is
right.
Kind of fun to learn stuff like that.
Yeah.
Final thoughts on the Crisis.
Well, can I throw out some things that you talked about that I think are fun and other some, there's like one or two higher concepts. Here's a silly thing. Early on, you were talking about Pariah. You kept calling him pink hair. He has purple hair.
Okay.
And I'm purple's my favorite color. So I was like, oh, I, you know, it probably shows up looking like pink in some of the things, but Adam from CGS actually cosplayed as Pariah in front of Perez one time. And he has a picture him, and it was, how amazing was that?
Now, Adam Murdo, anybody who might not know, he is probably considered another Crisis expert. In fact, when I teased the other day on the Event or Else Facebook group that I was having a Crisis expert come on the show, I think it was Ian Levenstein replied with something like, are you going to muddle through it? And I said, no, we're going to stump a little bit or something like that. But, he wrote, wasn't his, he write a thesis on, cause he was, remind me the course he was taking in college, first of all. I think it was a pop culture?
Yeah, it was like a pop culture course, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and he wrote his thesis on the Crisis, yeah.
And is it published out there on the internet?
Oh, yeah.
At one point
you can
out there?
Find it online. Yep, we have links to it, yep.
I should have read that before I even started this whole series, you know?
He reads from the thesis every now and then on whenever we do the Crisis tapes. He'll pull out a passage every now and then. Mm-hmm. I mean, he goes really high concept into the writing aspects of it, the revelations aspect of it, connections, metaphors, things like that. It's amazing. Yeah, it's really cool.
Yeah, how do you read it?
I haven't even read it yet. I like to hear it from his words.
Yeah.
Event or Else will return after these messages. And now back to Event or Else.
You in the second issue of Crisis, in your second episode, you talked about Anti-Monitor being in shadows. You know, I think you were wondering who we thought the readers were. You said something like, it's a new villain, so we don't know who he is yet. There was belief that this was not a new villain, but that it was an established villain.
Yeah.
And that was a lot of the mystery for those first 5-6 issues, because it was like, we had no idea who it was.
Right.
Some people thought it was going to be Darkseid. I don't necessarily remember. I probably didn't really think one way or the other because I was just so invested in the story. It didn't matter.
Yeah.
But I'm not necessarily sure. I can't remember if Wolfman purposely and Perez kept him purposely in the dark, no pun intended, because they wanted to have, number one, a big reveal later. They wanted to make sure that we got through Monitor stuff first before we got to the Anti-Monitor. Because really, the book is divided. First of all, it's divided in half. It's also divided in thirds every 4 issues. And it's also divided every 2 issues. If you really go in and sort of study like what Wolfman is touching on, every 2 issues is its own thing. Like, for instance, the Villain War is only 2 issues.
Okay.
The dealing with after they merge Earths 1 and 2, when they have to do 4 X and X S, that is 2 issues. You know, so everything's sort of divided up that way. So yeah, so the mystery of the villain was a mystery for some readers. And then probably the biggest thing that you talked about for a couple issues that is worth discussing is this notion of Superman, Batman, and Wonder Woman not being the main character.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
And that is absolutely on purpose. Wolfman did not want to use, definitely didn't want to use Superman and Batman because he wanted to showcase the larger DC universe. And he probably knew that he was going to use Superman of Earth 2, which you could argue is has a higher ranking than Superman of Earth 1 when you're talking about the multiverse, right?
Yep.
So that is absolutely, that was purposeful. To your point about Wonder Woman, she was going through so many changes in her books at the time that I feel they wanted to reflect that. But the other, the bigger notion is, and this is something that I've been meaning to study for a while, the very concept of the Trinity did not exist pre-crisis.
Yeah, right.
You know, certainly, Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman are very popular. Even some of the cartoons, you always had to have three of them. But the notion of them being the Trinity, the leaders of the DC universe.
Yeah.
You know, part of me thinks it's because of Kingdom Come more than anything that that really was a notion. So, yeah, it's great. It's great that we don't have them. It, you know, Hal Jordan doesn't even show up in the book at all. You know,
that's a good point. I didn't even think about that.
Yeah. It's all John Stewart.
Yeah.
And I think that's why when they did Infinite Crisis, and this was something that, at the time of reading it, some readers, it's not like they didn't agree with it, but it's almost like they almost willfully weren't looking at it this way. But Infinite Crisis really is a Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman story.
Yeah.
With the DC Universe in the background. Because it begins with them, it ends with them, it involves their philosophical differences, you know. And I think the writers of that purposely did that because they were not center at Crisis on Infinite Earths. So
I
think it's one of the things that's really great about what Wolfman did, because you could have easily made like an issue number one, the Blue Beetle scene, that could have been a Batman scene.
Yep.
But that's not as interesting, because then I never would have been introduced to Blue Beetle. You know?
Yeah.
So I thought that was great that you noticed that and that you took time to talk about that, because it's the main point.
You know, Superman, of course, you know, like you said, he, of the three of them, he has more to do than the three of them. But that, I think, is only because of, like you said, Superman of Earth 2. But yeah, Batman, he just, even when he was there, I mean, there's a moment near the end where all of the heroes go to fight it's before issue 11, before everything merges. They go to fight the Anti-Monitor. It's supposed to be the last battle. And like Batman and Robin and a couple others are just standing off to the side. And they're like, what are we supposed to do? And give them more moral support. And that's
right.
Why even put them there?
Right.
You know, I thought, I just found it interesting because you really don't see if it's a big story in the DC universe, the Trinity is front and center. And I don't know. I don't think I realized how much I appreciated that wasn't the case in this one until maybe near the end.
Yeah.
Because, it really did showcase a lot of characters that I'd never known before. And I love me some Blue Beetle. Love me. He's the opposite of Batman. I just, you know, if Batman was a happy person, that would be the Blue Beetle.
And right.
I think that's why I like him so much.
Cool.
Anything else? You got any other?
No, I mean, just to wrap up the crisis. I mean, if you're going to read it, maybe it's good to have, you know, the internet nearby in case you have questions for anybody who's first. Yep. I think your approach to it, especially the ones, I know you no longer do the video aspect of it, but that certainly helps from a visual aspect.
Yeah.
And you're real concise about the synopsis. There's a lot of reference material online. It should never be your first comic. That would just,
yeah.
It's like when people say, oh, you want to read comics? Go read Watchmen. It's like, No. Don't read Watchmen. Don't read Crisis. It was a moment in time. It has been duplicated. It has been copied. It has been emulated. It has been, you know, whatever. I think the only other event that comes close to it and actually might beat it in terms of everything was Blackest Night for me.
Yeah.
Because Blackest Night also, what it did that Crisis didn't do, Blackest Night also targeted merchandising, and it really brought fandom in. it was almost like they took what Secret Wars wanted to do and made it better, you know, because I remember the whole ring promotion thing that people were going nuts for. And in terms of a publisher goal, you want people to spend money during your events. Blackest Night made people spend a lot of money, just a ton. Yep. And over on Marvel's side, you know, I don't think they really had a big altering event until Civil War. Some people say Infinity Gauntlet, but that's just because Perez drew the first couple issues, you know?
Yeah.
It didn't really affect the larger Marvel universe as a whole, if you were reading it at the time. But Civil War fundamentally changed the Marvel universe, not only as a concept, but as in publishing, and did everything all the way even to influencing the movies. So those two later events for me are come closest to what Crisis's goal was. That you were able to power through, and it was fun to see you power through and not allow yourself to get bogged down by some of the stuff that could be confusing. Because if you really just follow it as a story, it's there. It's all there.
Well, you know, I think the advantage I have is that I'm not a real deep thinker. So for most stories, it's like, it's a lot of surface level for me. It's when I feel like I have discovered, you know, ooh, here's some deep inner meaning, and I learned that I'm probably the last one to realize that, you know. Well, I'll give you, have you read the Tom King Supergirl, Woman of Tomorrow?
No, not yet.
Well, I'm not going to give anything away, but there was a moment there that I was like, ah, I see what they're doing here. And it took me 4 or 5 issues to figure it out. And if you read about it, they tell you like it's supposed to be this. And it took me like 5 issues before I said, this feels familiar. And then once I realized what it was, I jumped on the internet. Oh, I've discovered something, and found out that everybody else already knew. So the next event, well, actually, I want to say real quick, because I think I mentioned it in the last couple of episodes, but I do want to remind folks, I did get away from the video aspect, because that's what has been causing the delays, is just the idea of putting those videos together. Ugh, it's a lot
beautiful.
Of work.
They're beautiful, and but it's a lot of work. Yeah,
I do it all on my freaking iPhone. That's all I have. And it's a lot of work, but I'm keeping the YouTube side up, because I may want to go back and finish the videos, you know, get it all completed. But so the next event we're going into is Secret Wars 2. Give me just first thing that pops to your mind when you hear Secret Wars 2.
A hot mess.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, that one, I'll be real interested to hear what you have to say under the topic of how does it read as a story versus do you need to read the tie-in?
Yeah. I read the first issue recently, and there were a number of moments in there that I'm like, where did this come from? This just, you know, there's a lot of stuff that happens that just seems to come out of the blue. But if you're reading the rest of the Marvel Universe, it makes sense.
Right.
And along with that, there's some of the tie-in issues. I read an issue of Captain America a couple of years ago that, you know, they all have in the corner, the front cover in the corner, Secret Wars 2 tie-in issue. And the only tie-in in the entire, I think it's the one, the issue where he's fighting the armadillo.
Armadillo, I have that issue, and,
yeah. Yeah, you get the Beyonder show up as just a white humanoid figure who's hiding in the background. He watches, he observes him at the beginning and he observes him at the end, and that's it. And that's the tie-in. There's, you know, it's, I think Jim Shooter saw what they were kind of trying to do with the Crisis, and he tried to do that there. And I don't think he really pulled it off.
Right. Yeah.
But yeah, I think that's going to be a real fun one to go through.
Good luck.
So, yeah, I don't know at this point, if we're going to start right away the following week. As of the time we're recording this episode, the episode for issue 9 went up, and we still have 10, 11, and 12, and then this. So I'm about 4 weeks ahead of the game, but I haven't quite read. When I read that issue of Secret Wars 2, it was last year. So
okay,
I'm ready to kind of dive in and, you know, start taking my notes and see what I can pull out of it. But yeah, that's going to be, I think, when the exercise of how much am I going to get out of this story without reading the tie-ins, I think this is the one that's going to test my sanity.
Absolutely.
This may be the one that I might decide I'm not going to do this anymore. I give up. I'm done. And I know that there's stuff coming up. You know, I think when I get into books like Secret Wars, the John Hickman one, I think that may be the one that pulls me out of doing this because, you know, I like John Hickman, but he just can sometimes his concepts just go over my head.
Yeah. I'm a fan of his work, actually. I adore that kind of, it's a little Morrison-y. I feel like he also learned some things from not 2000 AD, but just a different way to look at comics, you know? I love that work.
Jonathan Hickman, he just doesn't mess around.
Yeah.
If he's going to tell a story, from what I know about stuff like Secret Wars, he was hinting to that years before, he started his Fantastic Four run a number of years before that, and he was already putting the pieces in place.
Yeah.
And I find that amazing. I just for a brain to work like that, you know, that's the kind of stuff I do. I love it. I appreciate it. But
yeah,
sometimes if I don't understand what's going on right off the bat, it can sometimes throw me out.
Yeah.
But once I can figure it out, yeah, then I'm all in. But, you know, yeah, so that's what's coming up next, folks. Hopefully we'll get it going next week after this episode goes out. But stick around because Secret Wars 2 should be a lot of fun. Yeah. Peter, cool. I want to thank you for doing this.
Thank you.
You know, when I reached out to you, I just, the one question that was in my mind as I was reading, I think I was around issue 9 or 10, and I just thought, all I could think of was how people were reacting to Infinite Crisis at the time. And I wondered, how were people reacting to this at the time? Because as a general community, comic book readers don't like change.
No.
And this was a big change. They, you know, killing off Barry Allen, first of all, I mean, good Lord, I wonder how many people stopped reading DC Comics at that point, and how many have since come back. But
it wasn't enough. It wasn't enough, right?
Like, right.
Because
right.
Clearly, even if that amount left, DC gained so many more.
Yeah,
1986 is such a brilliant year for DC, and
it's a big year.
Yeah,
yeah. But I had another thought, and it wasn't. Oh, so basically, what I'm getting though from what I'm pulling out of this conversation is that as far as you and your contemporaries, the people that you talked to back then and maybe were hanging out with and was reading this stuff, the general feeling toward the crisis was pretty favorable.
The general feeling was favorable, and also almost couldn't get a hold of it.
Yeah.
Because it hadn't been done. So
yep.
It almost was like, oh, I don't know what they're going to do. You know,
right.
Every issue has some major moment. And at the end of issue 4, Earth 1 and Earth 2 are gone. And you're like, what? Wait, you know, and it's pre-internet. Yep. You don't, you know, you could certainly assume that things are going to last or going to survive. But no, I think it's literally you are on it for the ride. And you could be as negative as you want about it, which I'm sure many people were. But you had to follow it because this was your, if you were a DC fan, this was it. You had to know what was coming next. And there were some really great titles that came out of it.
Yeah.
And some not so great ones, but still, it's for those people who poo-pooed it and I did, there were some people who were already complaining about, oh, there's so many tie-ins and blah, blah, blah. And you're like, how do you even know there's so many? We haven't ever had anything like this before,
right.
You know?
Right.
So, sure, there were many detractors, but I guarantee they're still reading DC to this day, probably.
Yeah, and really, as far as the tie-ins, you know, as far as part of the experiment that I'm trying here is, again, to read just the core series to see if, you know, what I get out of it. Do you need to read the tie-ins? And no, This one, you don't need to read the tie-ins.
Absolutely.
I read this and I didn't know many of the characters in it, and I had a lot of fun with it. It's huge, it's sprawling, it's epic. The time and the care and the, you know, just everything that George Perez by himself just puts into it is just, yeah. It's amazing. It's just, yeah. I couldn't imagine what it would have been like. I have to imagine if I was a 12-year-old kid reading this for the first time, if that would have been one of my first books, I feel like my entire comics reading history would be much different nowadays.
Oh, sure.
I would have been more of a DC guy growing up than Marvel, but
yeah.
Since my brother wasn't getting it, then I wasn't getting it. So yeah. All right. I don't know that I have really anything else to ask. I'm sure that once we're done an hour from now, I'll be sitting on the couch going, damn, I should have asked him this. So,
it's a concept that is everybody always, you know, it's like, you got to cut your teeth on it. Right. If you're a podcaster, especially, it's the reason why people still talk about it. It's the reason why DC put out Dark Crisis on Infinite Earths, because it's that monumental that it just still resonates to this day.
Are you reading Dark Crisis?
I have not yet.
I have. I got a couple issues in. I haven't really gone back. I need to.
It's not the same.
I don't want to say it wasn't doing anything for me, but I think I need to. It might be complete now. I think it's done. So I should probably go back and read it. I don't think that's something I could have read month by month.
Yeah.
Again, really high concept stuff, you know, not just a multiverse, but a multiple multiverse. And some that just trying to wrap my head around that if my mind doesn't latch on to concepts, then I'm just lost. And so sometimes I got to wait till the whole thing's done and then sit down and read it all in one sitting. And that helps me a little bit more, but month to month, if I'm not grasping the concept, then I get to the next issue and I don't remember what happened in the previous issue.
Yeah. Yeah. My event reading stalled out, not because it was bad, but, I didn't finish Metal. I did read Heroes in Crisis. But in terms of what they were doing with the multiverse and all that, my knowledge stops around Metal, and I don't have it in my brain yet what's going on with like Dark Crisis and Justice League and all that was going with Perpetua. Even it's gotten a little too unwieldy for me as well. So
yeah, I've tried to read Metal twice now. So yeah. I
really do, because it was a twist on, instead of the multiverse, it was like the underneath, which I can handle that. That's cool. But now when you give me multiverses of multiverses of multiverse, like, okay, now I think we're done with this. Well, we need to move. DC needs to find a new way to tell events. And
this is it. You know, honestly, when it comes to these high concept things like that, once I can figure out what the theme is, what really are they trying to say? The all the metaphysical aspect of it, the science and all that doesn't affect me anymore. It's like, all right, I know the story that they're trying to tell now. But if, you know, speaking of Metal, when Scott Snyder, when he got onto Justice League, it was almost the same thing there. I read the first issue and there was just so many big things that he was throwing at you that I had to walk away. It was just too much.
Yeah.
So I think I feel like books like that, a Justice League, for example, you already know that you're going to get big epic stories. It's the Justice League, you know, but I feel like you need to start small. If you're going to start with a Justice League book, ease into it, you know, don't throw the giant universe concepts at the reader right away. Just let's get used to the characters a little bit first, you know, I don't know. That's just me. But again, thanks for coming on. I appreciate it. I didn't do this with Secret Wars, because really that is a surface book. You know, there's really not, you don't have to look deep in that one. It's I said it before. It's like a popcorn movie. It's just a lot of big explosions and a lot of fun. But this one is way deep And I felt like I had to round it out with a little discussion.
Very cool.
Yeah.
I'm thankful that I was able to help you out with that.
Yeah. Thanks.
I want to thank you for listening to this episode of Event or Else. Questions and comments can be directed to eventorelse@gmail.com. If you enjoyed the show, you can help to boost our presence online by leaving a rating or review on your favorite podcast app. I also invite you to join our subscription program, Stephen or Else Beyond. And in return, you'll get episodes of Event or Else along with every other podcast under the Stephen or Else umbrella, early and ad-free. Check out the link in the show notes or just go to eventorelse.com to join today. Event or Else is a presentation of Stephen or Else Media. For more nerdy content just like this, check out stephenorelse.com.
I don't think I can move through life knowing that a guy named Steven did this to me.
How could you let this happen, Steven?
Your podcast sucks.
What's the next event?
Ryan Seacrest here. When you have a busy schedule, it's important to maximize your downtime. One of the best ways to do that is by going to ChumbaCasino.com. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino games like spin slots, bingo, and solitaire that you can play for free for a chance to redeem some serious prizes. So hop on to ChumbaCasino.com now and live the Chumba life. Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply.